Hello and welcome to the Dementia Experience podcast. My name is Clara Hebblethwaite and I'm here today with the fantastic Sophie Lewis, who is a brilliant. Well, she's more than a friend. Like, she feels like a sister. She feels like someone that I've known for absolutely yonks. She's come up today from London to see us here, and we're going to have some hopefully brilliant freestyle conversation all about life and love and how to kind of get through the tough times. So, tell us, you are someone who works in the dementia world. You are someone who works for a charity called Music for Dementia. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, thanks very much for having me, Clara. It's a treat. Yes, I do some work for Music for Dementia, which is a charity, like it says on the tin, encouraging people to give music a go if they are caring for somebody with dementia or living with dementia themselves. And it's a very kind of optimistic charity in that it's meant to be for everyone. So it's not about being particularly exclusive about music. It's about saying that you don't need to be a musician to have use the power of music and get a lot of enjoyment from music. And I created a little film and met some wonderful people all over the UK who are living with dementia and using music really positively. And it really educated me as much as anything about how amazing music can be and how is, of course, isn't a cure or a remedy, but it really does help in kind of moments of difficulty to alleviate or change the mood in the room.
How did you sort of see the music work its magic when you were filming those families for the film that you were creating? What happened to the people involved?
Well, what was particularly amazing was suddenly, I mean, I think there are lots of things on the internet about where you suddenly see somebody come alive and, you know, remember all the words to lyrics, and those are amazing instances. But it was in sort of more smaller and more domestic settings that suddenly I would meet a couple, one of which might have dementia, and I would suddenly see a connection between the two of them that hadn't been there before the minute that they started talking about music. So they were no longer talking about the fact that one of them had dementia. They were talking about shared memories, and they were talking about tunes, and they were talking about what they had together and what they still have together, which is the moment of music, whether that's 3 minutes or 30 seconds or 20 minutes. So what was lovely about that was it was very much a leveler. So it wasn't suddenly somebody, it wasn't the carer and somebody with dementia, it was suddenly that they were a couple again, or they were a mother and daughter again. And that was a really sort of humanizing aspect to it.
Yes. So it's sort of, it's that secret language, isn't it? So only they speak and they sort of connect together in those moments.
Exactly.
And did they, actually that's interesting. They didn't even necessarily need to hear the music to have those moments of connection. Just reminiscing about music and the tunes that they loved.
Yes, exactly. And sometimes it would take a bit of coaxing. So somebody would say, you know that one, Mum, the one that goes da 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 da, and suddenly something would happen, and it would suddenly open a different part of the conversation. And I think another aspect was that I think a lot of agency is taken away from you when you get dementia, it seems. And I spoke to an amazing woman who said actually she loves going to singing groups because suddenly she's able to contribute again. And that was something where she felt like she had a sort of purpose again, which was really nice to think, yes, she could contribute, and she sang brilliantly, and dementia hadn't got that or taken that away from her. So that was a real sort of sense of empowerment from her, I think.
That's so interesting. And I imagine as well, particularly in a choir or that sort of communal setting, having a voice with others and taking a part, you know, to harmonize or whatever it is, you are contributing, and then you're all singing from the same hymn sheet, and the dementia perhaps is pushed away.
Absolutely. So you're connecting on a sort of number of levels. And I think, I mean, I certainly am not a scientist, but they do talk about how music connects many, it ignites lots of different areas of the brain at the same time. So I suspect the sort of choir aspect is communal. It's lighting up your sort of emotional space. It's doing lots of different things at the same time, which other things can't sort of connect to. Yeah.
I'm sure. Yeah, the brain being ferociously kind of gobbled up by dementia, somehow or other, music bypasses that and somehow or other finds its way to the heart, to the soul, to the life with it.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, even understanding how you're affected by music on a day-to-day living without dementia, you can feel how a particular track, or you're watching telly and it has a theme tune, suddenly you are transported immediately without even thinking about it to a memory, to a place, to a person. And, you know, those are the moments which obviously remain and are things that we can use and tap into with dementia, I think.
Yeah, definitely. So how did you come into Music for Dementia as a charity? Was that because of your PR and marketing background? And then why did you choose a charity such as that?
Yes, I met the fantastic MD of Music for Dementia, a woman called Sarah Metcalf, who I hope you'll get on here. And she is an incredible spirit and light in that space. She used to work for a charity in Scotland called Playlists for Life. And that was all about encouraging people to have their own playlists ready for if and when they got dementia, or creating playlists for grandparents or parents who might have dementia. So I met her, and then she moved across to work for Music for Dementia. And she really inspired me, I have to say. So she was somebody who I thought had a really positive outlook on the scene. And I think it's a hard thing to get that positivity, to find, as you always say, those nuggets of joy and gold and optimism when things look quite bleak and feel quite bleak. And I worked in advertising for a bit, and one of the best things they said about when you're working on a charity campaign is, although it's impactful emotionally to pull on people's heartstrings and, you know, present the seriousness of a particular issue like dementia or cancer, or actually in order to make people find a route through or engage with a message, you needed to find some level of optimism and hope in the messaging. And that's what's lovely about music and dementia, is that music is very definitely where we can, hand on heart, say it can give moments of respite and moments of joy. And I think working in dementia space, finding those areas is vital.
Yeah, because as we've said before, just as friends chatting, you know, so much emphasis is on the bleak side of dementia, isn't it? And it's so easy to default to that kind of perspective, because of course it is hugely miserable and distressing in so many ways. But yeah, our mission surely as human beings, whether we're directly caring for someone or not, is just to find light. And it doesn't have to be in a religious kind of spiritual sense necessarily. It just means, you know, even in conversation, you want to have a light touch. You want to be able to make people laugh and to find humour. And even when things, you know, are serious, you're not disregarding the seriousness of something by looking for the laugh that remains.
Absolutely. And actually, that was something I really noticed when I went and visited homes around the country with people living with dementia. Actually, I was quite nervous in going in and thinking, okay, is this going to be quite distressing? And I don't want to upset anyone by, you know, filming people. Everyone was unbelievably upbeat. And now I'm sure it's not like that every day. We know it isn't. But it's interesting that when you talk to people who are, well, like you, who are actually living with it and living through it, you have to find that in order to keep going. And I'm always amazed at when you meet care home staff, and they have that gallows humour, they have the day-to-day. This is what life is about, really, is coping with the bleakness, but carrying on and finding joy. And, I mean, you and I spend quite a lot of time laughing, don't we, about our mothers in various ways. And that is massively a coping. I mean, I would say music is one a helpful thing. Laughter is another in terms of being able to deal with it and process things that really are quite painful.
Yes, because the humour gives you the perspective.
Yeah.
It also gives that physical release, like dancing or shaking your booty in some way.
Yeah.
You know, you are shaking it off like good old whatever the singer would
say. Tay-Tay. Yeah. Tay-Tay.
Yeah. You need to shake it off.
Yeah.
And you see a dog, you know, when a dog gets nervous on a walk, the first thing it'll do after it's the, you know, the moment of fear has passed is physically shake.
Absolutely.
It's almost to say, right, let's get rid of that feeling and on to the next.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you don't have a laugh, if you don't physically move your lungs and your body up and down with that hysterical giggle, then it all just gets stored up and you're no use to anyone at that stage.
Definitely.
You know, you are almost going down the plug hole at the same rate as your loved one or the person, you know, with whatever bleak scenario that they're in.
Yeah.
You gently touched on the fact that we defo laugh about our own mums. Has your mum sort of changed in terms of her state of mind? How have things progressed with her?
Yeah. So my mum doesn't have dementia, but she has struggled with her mental health over the last 3 years, and that's been tough and tough on everyone. And I think you are inextricably linked to your family, and they, you know, the mother figure. I'm very close to my mum, and we have a lovely supportive family, which is great. But it's a bit like the keystone in a building. So the keystone in a building, if it shifts or if there's a crack in it or there's something, the ripples, you feel the ripples within the family. So I think that is something similar to dementia, because it's not, there isn't a simple answer. There isn't a drug you can take. There isn't a resolve. And I think that's a sort of living with this thing rather than trying to fix it. And I think our natural instinct, both as humans and children of parents, is we want to be able to help and we want to be able to fix it. And I think one of the things that definitely I struggle with is learning to think about how I can help without, whilst understanding I can't fix it. Which is clearly something with dementia, it's similar, I suspect.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've hit completely. That is spot on. It's learning to sort of live alongside it without managing, without controlling, without kind of interfering, as it were.
Yeah.
And allowing those layers to be shared due to mental illness or dementia. You know, they are both kind of frozen in a mentally disabled state, and it's painful to watch, beyond painful to watch. But yeah, actually, one of the biggest lessons I've learned is to just allow and not try and micromanage, you know, as my instincts would love me.
Yes, absolutely. And I was thinking, it sounds a bit sort of floaty, but I remember, you know, learning about mindfulness unrelated to dementia or looking after mothers. But there is something where certainly someone living with dementia, the only way to be is unbelievably mindful in a, well, what was this hour like? Yeah. You know, was it a good hour or was it not a good hour? What will the next 10 minutes be like? Did we have some nice connection there? You know, it's so concentrating on the now and what they're like here and now and today. And trying not to look, either look back or look forward, which is quite a tough thing, because I think we all do a lot of looking back and forward. Yeah. You know, you either mourn the person that you've lost or you look forward and try and fix. And I think it constantly, the only way to cope, which I am, I say it like I'm preaching this, but it's, you know, I struggle with it, but is to think, well, actually, now I've had a nice conversation with her or a nice moment, and it might not be again, you know, I might not have that tomorrow. And something about staying in that sort of time space is important, I suppose.
So true. So true. And I almost, and it will sound ridiculous, but I almost sometimes think you're almost sent the situation that you need.
Yeah.
And I felt it with my son as well, you know, in terms of just adjusting to life as a mum. And then I definitely feel it now, adjusting to my life as a daughter of a mum with dementia.
Yeah.
The here and now, something that I almost poo-pooed in the past.
Yeah.
You know, only a few years ago, I would poo-poo the here and now. I was like, give it a rest. I'm focused on the ambitions of the future and, you know, things that I would plan for and get excited for. And yeah, the here and now got almost forgotten about. And it's, yeah, it is the now that matters and making the most of every second. But you always have to have a crisis in order to realise that.
You do, you do. And I think it's then about how you deal with that crisis, because there are lots of different ways. But, you know, I'm just as a fellow complimentary session to you, but I'm incredibly impressed with how you've turned that, you know, your mum getting ill into actually an enormous force and energy for good. And I think I was listening to Nick Cave talk on Desert Island Discs the other day, and he talked about the death of his two children, how he was clearly overwhelmed by that, but was flooded with this feeling of support out there by people who wanted to, you know, walk out in Brighton, and people wanted to come up and basically, you know, support him. And but he has used that as an energy and a fuel to go on and to want to help other people. And I think if you can not ignore it, I think there's an element of it's not going away. You have to look at this thing that's in the room. But if you can think, why has that happened, and how can I make something from it, you know, make something positive from it.
And in their honour.
Yes, absolutely.
It still means that actually, yeah, the situation isn't at all wasted.
Yeah.
Their distress isn't at all wasted. And I do talk to mum about, you know, the dementia experience, and I give her posters to hand out so she feels like she's part of things. But yeah, so her demise, I say we are teaching the next generations how to deal with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
She feels good by that. She might not literally understand what that means, but I can see her little face change and feel like she is being useful.
Absolutely. And your parents are people who shape you for good and bad, yeah. Whatever you know, you can't really avoid that. So, but we often think about, you know, what are the good bits that I've inherited from my parents, and what are the bad bits, and how do I want to? But actually, something like this, thinking out, you would never have gone into this space had it not been for your mum. So I mean, you know, we can't quite go as far as saying it's a gift, because it does get all very sort of Pollyanna-ish, but
yeah.
The idea of thinking, actually, I'm gonna turn this god-awful situation into something quite cool. Yes. You know, that's something,
it's too obvious to be miserable.
It's too obvious. And so, also, where does it get you?
Yeah,
you know, that
bit, flick the bird.
Yeah.
At the obvious.
Absolutely.
Say, I'm going to flip this and I will keep you on your toes.
Yeah.
And make sure that you are constantly surprised by my response.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's got to be cruel in every way, not just in work, but in general day to day life.
Definitely. Definitely.
Cruelest thing, or the most recent cruelest thing that you've done, is your fantastic reincarnation club. And that is something that is based on the idea of flipping it, turning, you know, a sad situation into something that is then possible for you to actually quite not enjoy necessarily, but to feel connected.
Well, to live on, to live on, which, so my forever love is clothes, and I have a clothes label, and I make and design clothes. What I really love is I love the story behind clothes, and they're as individual as people, really. With Reincarnation Club, I do a lot of reincarnating, which is turning old clothes, recutting and redesigning them so that they can be worn again. Yeah. And I had quite a few people, actually. It was my mother-in-law. My gorgeous father-in-law died a year or so ago, and he had lots of clothes. He loved his clothes too. And he had lots of jackets. And there was one particular jacket that was a red tailcoat, which is a bit moth-eaten, but it was his, I think he was a captain of a golf club at one point. So it was his jacket. And I said, well, I could recut it and turn it into a woman's jacket. And I did. And I gave it back to my mother-in-law. And it's a beautiful, I changed the sleeves, I could change the cut of it. But there's something lovely about that because it's a part of him. And I've done a pop-up in a funeral director's called Exit Here. And so I'm encouraging people because I think sorting out people's clothes after they die is quite a big issue. And they can, you know, it's unbelievably emotional. The smell of somebody's clothes, the feel of them, they really do make you think about the person again. And a lot of the time people don't want to go into that wardrobe. They want to leave them as long as possible. But Reincarnation Club is about saying, come and tell me the story of your loved one. What particular piece of clothing or clothing, you know, pieces of clothing remind you of that person? Is there something that I can redesign and recreate for you to then wear, which is something slightly different from wearing your late mother's clothes? It's actually you've turned it into something new. And I think that is the nature of reincarnation, is that from the phoenix, you know, the phoenix from the flames, the ashes, something dies, but from that we can create something new. And there's lots of debate about, you know, whether we should we need to sort of learn from death and go on and enjoy life again. And I think that's what it is it's enjoy the memories of somebody and create a new piece of clothing that you can wear proudly and look fantastic in, obviously. Yeah. But the nice thing about it is when someone says, oh, I like your jacket, you then get to tell the story of your mum. You know, you then get to say, well, actually, the fabric came from my mum who used to love this type of clothing. And, you know, maybe she died a couple of years ago. But you then pass on the memory. Not only do you get a lovely compliment about your jacket, you then tell the story of your mum and she sort of lives on again. So, oh, yes, yeah, yeah. I made my husband a pair of jeans and I lined the pocket with his father's shirt fabric. And that was something that was very quiet. It was a very sort of private thing. So it was only, Tom was the only person that knew that lining his pockets was his father's shirt. And he said it makes him think, you know, when he's in a meeting, he puts his hand in his pockets, his sort of dad is, a little bit of his dad is still there with him. And that is a really lovely, lovely thing to carry around if you get on with your parents. Yeah. You don't want to have your mum there in every meeting, but
Yeah, I love it. So as you say, they live on, but it's a new creation.
Yeah.
As are you. After they've died, you want to keep them in your heart. You want to keep them in your pockets. But in their name, you are living a full life on the other side of their very sad, very tragic death.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And again, it's just too obvious to only wear black after someone's death.
Yes.
It's too obvious to mourn in that way when they, looking from above or wherever they are, in the wind, in the stars, in the wherever, they want to see you enjoying life.
Enjoying life. Yeah. And be thinking, oh, look what they've done with my coat. Yeah. Isn't that? Well, I wouldn't have done that with the sleeves, but, yeah, you know, she did always like bright colours. Yeah. Whatever the, you know, I like that idea that there's that conversation between somebody who's no longer there. And actually, we were talking about that the other day, about how even when they're no longer with you, there's something about you still want to do, impress them, do right by them, yeah, have their commentary on something. You could still hear the what the commentary might be. And I think that's the power of memories, and that's the power of families, really, for better and for worse. But the idea that the conversation continues even if they're no longer with you.
Yes, so it's not a full stop. There's a wonderful dot, dot, dot about it,
yeah,
and allows you to go into the new chapter. But what a refreshing outlook. You know, we're so often in the Western world in particular, you know, so frightened of death, so nervous of saying the wrong thing at someone's funeral or knowing that someone's unwell with dementia or mental health illness and just tiptoeing around it in a very sort of odd way when, you know, the people involved in those distressing scenarios are so needing connections, so needing humour, so needing someone to say, oh my gosh, with that glorious shirt of your mum's, I could, you know, help you create something new that you can always have and love and live alongside. And we've just somehow or other in the West got it wrong.
I know.
So far. I mean, I'm hoping this is part of a new movement.
Me too. Me too. Because actually, I think, and in fact, the funeral parlour I did the pop-up in, it's called Exit Here, which even the name, I mean, which I think is absolutely fantastic. Some people are a bit, oh, you know, I hope that's not making light of the dead, you know, and actually
quite the opposite.
Goodness, quite the opposite. I mean, who wouldn't want to exit that? I certainly would. But
isn't it written in pink neon?
Oh, it's in neon. Yeah, yeah. I mean, fantastic. Yeah. That's the way to exit life, isn't it? So, and I think that, again, like dementia, like mental illness, it's not, death is unavoidable. Yeah. So do it in style, you know, to go out in style.
Yes.
Talk about it. I mean, that's a lot of the, you know, donating organ. I remember working on a campaign about getting the conversation about, do you want to donate your organs? And we should all be having those conversations with our loved ones now. But again, the sort of don't mention the death word.
Yeah.
It is so sort of stiff upper lip and kind of old school British, isn't it?
And it means we're sort of, we're putting a block on talking about death, which means we're probably somehow repressed in life.
Yes.
You know, we've got to be able to set free about death in order to be able to set free fully in life.
Absolutely, absolutely. And now, you know, going back to reincarnation, I used to love the idea that you get reincarnated as a slug or a snail or something like that. That thinking about the life that might happen beyond this one, and I don't mean specifically to any religion or anything like that, but it's kind of fun. You think, well, actually, you've transferred to a different dimension. That's much more entertaining than thinking, well, that's it, you know, end of, let's not talk about it.
Yeah.
And I think anyone sort of having that energy and imagination about something which is deemed to be dark and doomy should be, it sort of enlivens it somehow. Yeah. It gives it some energy. And I think that's another thing about dealing with loved ones, caring for loved ones, is trying to, where do you get the energy? Where do you get the adrenaline injection to keep going, to call again, to visit your mum, to, when you think this is going to be tough, it's going to be tough, you know, where can I get my fuel? You know, we often talk about being fueled, and it's thinking about, where do you get that fuel? Do you get it from creativity? Do you get it from laughing? Both of those I do. But, you know, seeing people that you love who you can talk about the whole gamut of emotions, from crying with them to absolutely, you know, roaring with laughter. And that's really cathartic, I think. And that's where, I mean, that's certainly where I get my fuel from, because you have to keep that tank going, don't you?
Absolutely, yeah. Because as you say, yeah, that caring role, it couldn't be more draining.
Yeah.
I remember even phoning mum before she really kind of was properly cooked. I remember phoning her and I said, well, hi mum, it's Clara. And she was like, you're my carer. I don't want to care. I thought, it's true. Like, just the word carer is so miserable.
I know.
So I would love to be not care homes, but Clara homes.
Yes.
You know, and have them painted in hot pink and orange.
Absolutely.
And have, you know, the celebration. And it's still fully respectful. It's still, of course, sensitive. Of course, it's empathetic. All of the above, you know, will obviously go without saying. There's no need to spell that bit out.
Yeah.
But why not have an injection of life at the point of death?
Yes.
You know, all of those lovely old ladies on my mother's dementia wing would way rather go out in a ball of flames, you know, than have some dreary old lift music, you know, kind of soothing them into the ground.
Completely.
You know, my mum once, Tina Turner on full blast.
Yes, yes. And I love, you know, I came to see you and your mum and just watching that dancing, the, you know, Donna and her disco pom-poms, and that, it was all so brilliant. And I thought, yeah, that's the way to do it. And that, you know, People don't feel like that every day. Yeah. But you just want to have a bit of energy, a bit of release. And my God, we feel like that sometimes. If you want to stick on music and have a bit of a kind of dance, it can make you feel so much better. And I do, yes, I think you're right. Over in this side of the world, we aren't good at dealing with death, and that people can be very stiff and snooty about it. And I don't think that helps. I think it just is sort of represses the misery somehow. Yeah. Oh, it doesn't repress the misery. That would be okay.
What
but
does
it,
repress the misery mean?
I mean, what I mean is exacerbates the misery.
Yeah. And looking at models abroad, you know, we know in Sri Lanka, we know in Mexico, you know, Mexico has Day of the Dead.
Yeah.
It's the biggest party in the calendar.
Yeah.
You know, it is about hurrah for that life. And yeah, that I definitely think we need to hold on to, or at least, yeah, be inspired by.
Yeah.
So we talked about the maternal kind of pressure that we feel as moms, but also as daughters of moms who are suffering. And I've mentioned in previous podcasts as well, as many other people are no doubt discussing, that idea of us being kind of stuck in the middle.
Yeah.
And we thought by now we'd be backpacking again around Thailand, but instead we're like, you know, either sort of spinning a plate with in our mother's household, whether that be at the care home or at home, or with our own children. I mean, you know, all of that is so hardcore.
Yeah. I mean, the never-ending umbilical cord. Yeah. That's what I think. It's like, yeah, you know, it's either you attached to your own mother, or you're the mother attached to your children. Yeah. And
they're free spirits. I don't want either.
You don't want to be, you know, it does feel like you are tied to those things. And yeah. And I think it is an interesting time, because still having teenage children and then having parents who need you as well, it can be quite a strain. And again, the only way through is to sort of, is the gallows humour, is to laugh at it.
Yeah.
And to be able to, and even, I mean, the idea of, you know, it's a sort of classic, well written about, the idea that you then, as you get older, you regress to being a child again.
Yeah.
That whole cycle, you very much see it from being in the middle. But I do think, and again, it sounds like sort of trying to, the silver lining aspect is you do get a massive perspective. You suddenly see these things, and you look at your children and you look at your parents, and you sort of have that moment of thinking, I am in the middle of all this.
Yeah.
And what can I take from it? What can I learn from it? How am I going to do the next 24 hours?
And also appreciating that all the experience up until this point is equipping you, or has been equipping you for this current scenario, that there's always kind of a reason for all of those scenarios in the past. And it has just been building up your armor without you even knowing.
Yeah.
When you are faced with a crunch of any description, you are prepared.
Definitely.
And it may take some longer than others to adjust to the scenario, but you have been given the armor over those previous chapters.
Yeah. And you are able to use the tools. I mean, that's the thing. It's like the sort of tools, what tools have you got in your toolbox to be able to, and the thing is, it's crafty about life is it always presents a new scenario which you aren't tooled up for, so you sort of have to be able to go, oh yeah, I've been here before, I remember, how can I manage this? And then there are moments where I've never been here before. And that was one thing, actually, back to the funeral aspect, is that the interesting thing about learning about death and funerals is that nobody does it until crunch time, until they have to. And actually, that's one of the worst times to do it, because you're in an emotional state. You know, you're quite fragile because somebody has just died, and you're having to deal with a whole load of logistics. And actually, something about, there's something to be said with talking about it earlier when you're in a better state of mind to be able to think about all of those things.
Yeah.
But of course, we never do. You know, that's a sort of human nature thing, is you just don't until it sort of crashes into you.
Yeah, but. Were death to be presented in a different way, you know, with that sort of hot pink and orange and Tina Turner vibe, maybe we would talk about
it
and be prepared a lot earlier.
Absolutely.
Not sort of wait until it, as you say, that sort of awful crunch time when it's the worst to sort of approach it in that at that point.
Yeah. And I think that middle point, the thing I'm obsessed with is being aware of sort of your brain's plasticity and how much we get, as we get older, we get stuck in the way that we do things and the way we think about things. And it's sort of, I feel it's so important to try and challenge that at the moment in this sort of midpoint to go, try something new, do think about it in a different way, turn something upside down, look at it inside out. Because the older we get, that is just the pattern in which our brains sort of start to seize up in the same way as, I mean, it's a muscle. So in the same way as our muscles do. So exercising the idea of trying to look at something from a different perspective, trying to take on something different and new is scarier as you get older, but it's also sort of vital to keeping your mind sort of squishy and agile.
Yes. And your mind being squishy and agile will allow you to adjust to new scenarios because they are bound to come your way.
Yeah.
And you need that kind of oil, the sort of, like, this is one of my worst words, lubrication.
I don't know what you mean, Clara.
But you need that juice to kind of keep things, you know, moving.
Yes.
And maybe, yeah, the juicy stuff is the music, is the friendship, is the laughter. Like, why there's not something on TV yet, like, that's the key word, yet, about, you know, how grim or, you know, how hilarious all of this is.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much about motherhood, there's so much about, you know, workplace kind of dramas, et cetera, et cetera. Like, this is the chapter of life that so many people are struggling with.
Definitely. And I think the thing that I find fascinating is that even in this changed state of mind, whether that's mental illness or dementia, or your mother is always your mother. So it is unbelievable the way she is still able to say something that will cut you to the quick. And that is why there's a fantastic book actually called Travelers to Unimaginable Worlds. I'll give you the title, but it's about how we as connected carers, so people who are caring for loved ones, are so vulnerable because our loved ones still have all the tentacles, emotional tentacles wrapped around us. So they have the baggage and the history. We have the baggage and the history with that person. So even not in their right mind, they can say something which hurts you. And that you have to deal with those things. And that's really tricky. Like, you might be able to, like, you know, your brilliant Clara Holmes. We've talked about before how we thought actually I might be better sometimes to help your mum because I wouldn't have the tentacles wrapped around me. I wouldn't feel the lacerations in the same way as you might, and vice versa.
Yeah, if we did a
mum swap, because we'd make better, not better, but might not be so painful every day to deal with someone else's mum. And I think that's another aspect that isn't talked about, that there's something specific to, rather than being a career carer who works in a care home, something very specific to being related to that person. Knowing them of old, knowing them before this transformation has happened.
It doesn't necessarily do them any favours.
No.
Because all those buttons are being pressed both ways.
And you're looking for connection, quite rightly so, but it's sometimes the connection which is so hurtful, because they can say something which goes much deeper than to somebody who wouldn't know them so well.
The guilt trip aspect.
Absolutely. And the siblings aspect, you know, who's caring the most and how are you showing your care?
Yeah.
And there's lots and lots of sort of stuff around that.
Yeah, and we as humans, we are our most vicious with our nearest and dearest.
Yeah.
Whereas, when there's a stranger or fresh blood at the table, we all kind of up our game.
Absolutely.
So I know mum is a different person with the professional carers, definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, she's still naughty, but yeah, she wouldn't press the buttons emotionally.
No.
She would with me as her daughter.
Yeah, exactly.
And the variety of different humans coming in and out of her room rather than just the intensity of one.
Yes. And the flip side, you know, as we were saying in the middle, when you look at your own children, how delightful they are with other people's parents. And
swap
how, can we just swap everything out?
Yeah,
and then
husbands. Yeah,
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. And it's true. We know with au pairs or we know with teachers. Yeah.
Yeah.
Our children.
Nothing like somebody else to step in and suddenly you're dealing with. And it is simply because of the tentacles, I think. It's because you feel those. You're so connected that there's no impartiality there. You're wounded all the time, really. I mean, that's something I was going to ask you. Have you found that you've had to build up a kind of defense, sort of wall, or not wall is wrong, a persona to help you deal with your mum? Yeah. Or are you?
Yeah, definitely. I'm a character now in the care home when I visit, absolutely. And I have to build up to the role, you know, just as an actor would going on stage. And then it takes me a while to kind of come out of character. So it's almost like I need to go to a green room and I just flick on Below Deck or something. kind of chill out with. But yeah, I definitely have to kind of process it after. If I'm Clara in the care home, if I'm the real deal, I'm way too vulnerable. Mum can see I'm way too vulnerable and it doesn't work for either of us.
Yeah.
So I turn it on and I lipstick up. And sometimes I wonder if the confusion in her face when she sees me isn't necessarily just the dementia. She's just thinking, what the hell are you wearing?
Why are you dragging? Who's this?
Yeah. So colourful, so kind of odd. But yeah, I guess sort of entertainer, you know, rather than Clara. It's too painful to be me.
Yeah.
But then even within the act, and she'll act, she'll also up her game when she's with me, when I'm in that sort of character, and we feed off each other. But even within that, the other day, I was in character, but I very gently wiggled the gold chain around her neck that has a T for Trish. So it had been at the back of her neck, and I just wiggled it around to the front. And I must have just gently tapped, you know, that part that's so emotionally kind of charged, you know, her chest. And I just went, oh, well, there we are. And that was quite a maternal thing to do. And it must have then, in her mind, triggered something that reminded her that she is my mum. And she just very deeply and very sincerely looked into my eyes and said, I really did love you both. And she meant, you know, my sister and I. And of course, I had to just immediately leap up and quickly try and remember the code to exit, because it was just so powerful and glorious. And, you know, it was very sort of, you know, emotionally charged, but it was gorgeous as well.
Yeah.
Because in that moment, she was my mom. But no way, Jose, could I be Clara, you know, for 40 minutes at a time or even 10 minutes, because it's just too distressing.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah, so she acts, as she did during most of her life, she acts at the care of like the ambassador's wife, meeting and greeting, and it's a constant drinks party. I mean, sometimes she's half naked, but that's not a matter at all. Keep everyone on their toes. And yeah, I then come and go as and when the vibe is right for me and the vibe is right for her. And I'm also very good at checking out. If I arrive and it's just not the right time for her or for me, then I'll just very quickly leave. And that's luckily for me, the joy of her just being down the road in her care home.
That, yeah.
You know, I can just sometimes go for 20 seconds and then I just realize it's not going to.
And do you have anything where you, after the visit, you do to sort of like a decompressing or a, no
telly, like I know I love dog walking and I love being with friends and I love what's it called, Carver. And definitely those things work for me, but often I just need quiet. And I don't want to, you know, immediately phone a family member and download it, because that's almost like, oh, I don't want to relive it, and describe it and discuss it and dissect it. I just want to distance myself a little, have a sort of quiet hour or two, and then just regroup and get back on the horse.
Yeah.
And definitely with the work that we're doing now with the dementia experience, that helps hugely, because it's like, right, not only does it tool me up, you know, using your kind of idea of getting those tools in place. And I love the idea of a lesbian, by the way, with her tool.
Tool belt. Great. I could probably make one of those for you. Yeah. I'll make you an emotional tool belt.
I love that so much.
Good.
And with bullet holders.
Absolutely. Well, absolutely. Some cyanide, just in case you need to check out.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Valium.
Sure. We can make that. It would look quite good, I think. I'm just designing it in my head as we speak. It would be kind of like a holster for lots of different things. Sort of for you and just a survival pack, really. Yeah.
Because, yeah, that is essential. Like, stuff the first aid kit. I mean, I'm going to need more than a blaster.
Absolutely.
But, yeah, I think all of us need that tool belt, really. And then you just sort of, you grab the tool you need on that particular day, which is why you need the flexibility of mind to know which tool to go for. And also to acknowledge when, oh, bugger, you know, my tool belt does not hold the thing that I need. Instead of going down into a sort of dark place, you know, with the worry of that or being frozen by that fact that you're sort of disabled in some way and can't help with whatever the scenario is. Now, I definitely know there is help out there. Like, there are the right people in the right place who have been there, done that, got the t-shirt. And it's just a case of finding them and knocking on doors. And if they don't open, either move on to the next one or knock a bit louder.
Yeah.
You know, there is definitely, there's, you know, you're not on an island. There is definitely support, you know, left and right. It's just a case of, yeah, having a go at reaching out. And I remember a godparent saying that, just keep reaching out, whatever the scene, just ask for help and have no problem with that.
That's really good advice.
Not to care when someone says, sorry, computer says no.
Yeah.
Just say, okay, stuff you and on to the next.
Yeah, no, that's really good advice. That's really sort of, and keep asking the questions as well. You know, what else could you do? What, is there somebody else? How could you? And also the honesty, I think we've talked about this, but the honesty in going, that was really hard and now I need a stiff drink, and to watch some rubbish telly, because, you know, it's not just a sort of bulletproofness, is it? It's not just kind of, I'm okay, yeah, and then crash. Yeah. You know, I've done that before. Yeah. That sort of, Everything's fine. I can cope. I'm carrying it. As you're going. Yeah, exactly. As you're screwing yourself into the ground.
Yeah.
And then you fall over. So the kind of open dialogue, but the dialogue between going, today isn't a great day. Yeah. And I feel more, I always listen. I always go on a walk every morning and I try and just catch snippets of other people's conversations because I always find them fascinating. And you never know. It's always out of context. Mm. And I walked past this girl the other day and she was saying to her friend, I mean, I just feel like an egg without a shell.
Oh.
And I thought, I know that feeling.
Yeah.
I know, I'm going to remember that.
Yeah.
You know, and some days you really do feel like an egg without a shell. And other days you've got an armor-plated shell and you feel bombastic. So that feeling of going, yeah, that's all right, I'm having a, you know, egg without a shell day today, or a visit that's tipped you into that, is really kind of important as well, isn't it?
Yeah, defo. Oh, so we could talk forever.
We will go on and keep going.
Yeah, even when the lights are off in the studio, we will still
be here.
It's been amazing.
Oh.
Always so insightful, always so exotic, erotic. And exciting talking to you. So thank you.
Well, I love talking to you, Clara, and I think what you're doing is brilliant.
Thanks, so lots of love.